Our job for tonight is to go back to a subject we've actually talked some about, and that is reliance damages. And we saw reliance damages mostly when we talked about Section 90, and we talked about the fact that the restatement of contract second, Section 90 says that a remedy shall be limited as justice requires, and that the interpretation given to that by the restatement and by others, has been that it's really reliance damages, not expectation damages. And some courts disagree with that, and some courts go ahead and will give damages in a Section 90 case similar to damages they would have awarded if the contract had been fully supported by consideration. What we didn't talk so much about were two things. Number one is reliance damages outside of the context of Section 90. That is, when might you want to ask for reliance damages even though your contract was fully supported by consideration? And what exactly, conceptually, is the relationship between reliance and expectation? So I want to start there, and then we'll talk about security stove. Some people have said, and you'll notice there's some mention of this in the casebook, that if you want to think about expectation, one way of thinking about expectation is to say that the goal is, first, to compensate for all reliance expenses, reliance expenditures, and second, to compensate for loss of profit. And that every expectation recovery involves, therefore, a reliance recovery. And conceptually, that is true. It's not how we normally think about it, but it is correct. The other way of saying that is that what you forfeit when you ask for reliance damages is you forfeit the opportunity to ask for loss of profit. And that leads you to what happened in Security Stove in this sense. What happens if in the transaction you don't plan on making a profit out of the transaction? So when this stove was sent, at least not out of this transaction itself, when the stove was to be sent to Atlantic City to show off at a heating convention, it was not their goal to make money out of that particular transaction. They were taking the stove to show it. Obviously, there was prestige involved. Prestige sometimes later translates into profit. There was even the possibility that they might draw the attention of one particular, but maybe one or more manufacturers who might want to license this technology from them, because there was a lot of interest in that at that point and now in dual fuel furnaces. But no profit being made from the transaction itself, because they didn't plan on selling the stove in Atlantic City. And they didn't have even the immediate goal of licensing it in Atlantic City. It was a show. So therefore, if you stop and think about their economic situation, you'd say, all right, well, if we give them reliance damages, since they had no expectation of profit anyway, they would be fully compensated. So in a way, this is an easy case to see why it is that they wouldn't ask for expectation damages. Now, if courts approached expectation damages by saying, okay, well, we'll give you your reliance expenditures, and then we'll give you your profit. Okay, here are your reliance expenditures, or we'll talk about what they were. Oh, yeah, but you don't have any lost profits, so that's zero. But the difficulty is that courts are accustomed to think about expectation in a different way. They say, well, the goal of expectation is to put the injured party in the position they would have been in had the contract been performed. Great. What position would they have been if the contract had been performed? They would have lost, they would have spent the money on the transportation, they would have spent the money on the hotel room, they would have spent the money on the booth in the Atlantic City Convention Hall, and they would have gotten what? Nothing. Nothing that's measurable. Nothing that's quantifiable. And so the court could look at it and say, oh, you don't get anything. Well, the lawyers wanted to avoid that. So the lawyer said, okay, Your Honor, we're not suggesting expectation as the appropriate remedy in this case. We're suggesting reliance. Now, there are some interesting things about the reliance damages here. When Lon Fuller and his student Perdue wrote the article on reliance that really was at the heart of all modern reliance law, they drew a distinction, which I'm going to talk about, but if it confuses you, just forget it, right? So this is one that's designed to be helpful, but if it's not helpful, don't let it trouble you. They suggested that when you think about reliance, there are really two kinds of reliance that occur in every contract transaction. One of them they label essential reliance. And of course, they labeled the other one incidental reliance. And that's one of the sources of confusion, because incidental reliance has nothing to do with incidental damages, nothing at all. They share the word incidental, that's all. Well, what do you think they would mean by essential reliance, like security stove? What would be the essential reliance in security stove? What kind of reliance was essential in the sense that it was part of their performance obligation under the contract?
That all the parts had to be delivered regardless.
No, I was thinking about the security stove's part. What was their essential reliance?
The freight charge?
Oh, you think that it was the cost of delivery to the...
It would be that they would get it by...
No. What? Remember, when we talk about reliance, we mean think first and foremost about money spent. Because that's at the heart of reliance, is what you had to write a check for.
The freight charge?
The freight. The cost of freight. Their essential reliance, if you think about their promise was to pay money, to pay the freight. So they would say, in this case, the essential reliance is the cost of the freight. What's the incidental reliance? Everything else. Everything else. Because none of the other things were part of contract performance. It was part of the contract as they saw it. It was the transaction that they had imagined. You can really test this out by saying, okay, let's remember Hadley versus Baxendale. If we're talking about essential reliance, do we have to worry about foreseeability? Think about that. If we're talking about essential reliance, that is the activity which the party is compelled to do in order to perform the contract, would we have any concern about foreseeability as a limitation on contract remedies?
You wouldn't, because incidental damages are only part of foreseeability.
Well, but what can we say about the relationship between foreseeability and essential reliance?
I was going to say that essential reliance would always be foreseeable because it's part of what needs to be done.
Essential reliance is always foreseeable because it defines the contract obligation, or if you want, the consideration. Right? That's what it's about. It's about what you have to do in order to perform your part of the contract. What the stove company had to do to perform their part of the contract was to pay. Interestingly enough, suggested that it had to be to take the freight to the freight station. Not really. If from the standpoint of the freight company, you've paid them. That was your contract performance. If you don't ever bring the goods to them, oh well, so what? That's not their problem. They promised to carry the freight that you gave them. You didn't give them any freight, so what? However, if you didn't pay the money, then you've breached the contract. So essential reliance is the contract performance. And obviously it's a foreseeable, you know about it. That was what you did in exchange for. That's what they made a promise of carriage in exchange for the promise of money. Okay. That means, necessarily, obviously, that if we're talking about incidental reliance, that is all subject to foreseeability, the foreseeability limitation. So how do we get around foreseeability here when we're talking about hotel rooms and time spent away from the job by the president and a worker, cost of a booth in a convention hall in Atlantic City? Why doesn't the principle of foreseeability prevent their recovery in this case? This is a really easy question. It's almost like Grant's tomb.
They explained it to
him. Absolutely. I think three times, I think. Certainly at least twice. They explained it to him. They told him the whole thing. I can just imagine a bored clerk in the railroad office saying, spare me the details. I don't want to know about your business life. Just what do you want us to carry? No. They had to tell him the whole thing. Of course, the reason they did, remember, is they were so concerned about getting it to Atlantic City by October 8th. They wanted to know when they would have to deliver it to the freight yard for carriage in order to make sure that it got there by October 8th. And they went through a whole elaborate explanation of why it was that they were doing this. And so the court wasn't troubled by the issue of foreseeability. But would foreseeability apply? Absolutely. Okay. Now there is one interesting expenditure here that the court doesn't spend a lot of time thinking about, but we're going to need to because it comes up in the Anglia case, in the English TV case. One of these expenditures they had made before they made the contract with the freight yard. Do you remember which one that was? The booth. The booth. Yeah, they had arranged for a booth. How could that be recovered? If by reliance expenditure we mean money that is spent in reliance upon the contract, doesn't that necessarily mean that it has to be reliance that is engaged in after the contract is made? How can it be an expenditure before the contract was made? Tricky question.
Well, because if they have performed the contract, then there will be no loss for...
There's no doubt about the fact that if they had performed the contract, there would be no loss. But
so
I've asked a different question, though. I've said the term reliance seems to suggest that what it seeks to compensate is expenses made in reliance on what? Not in reliance on performance, but in reliance on the contract. Did the contract exist at the time that they got the booth? And the answer is no.
Could you argue that they booked the booth in, like, assuming that they would get the freight deal, so therefore they were relying on that assumption?
Right. And why was that a reasonable assumption? Do you know? Can you tell? There's something said in the decision that tells you this, but you may not have noticed it.
Well, because otherwise, how would you get it there?
Well, that's true. That's true. But could the freight company have refused to carry it? They could not. That's the theory of recovery here. They could not refuse it. Why? Because a freight train, is something called a common carrier. And under the law, common carriers are not allowed to refuse to carry. Now, that's not quite true. They can refuse to carry something that's inherently dangerous. but they can't refuse to carry anything else. So if you're in Manhattan and you want to take a taxi cab to Brooklyn, and the taxi driver you stop says, oh no, I don't go to Brooklyn, he is violating the law of New York, because the taxi cab is a common carrier. And he must take you anywhere within the city of New York. If a hotel refuses to rent you a room, they are violating the law, because they are a common innkeeper. And common innkeepers cannot refuse rooms if they are available, unless you present a current and immediate danger to the hotel. Where does this law come from? This is old English and American law. Goes back 500, 600, 700 years or more. It doesn't cover lots and lots of businesses, but it covers the ones we're talking about now. So the answer to my question really was, it didn't trouble the court because they said that they could rely upon the freight carrier carrying it, because the freight carrier could not refuse it. I'm going through this mostly because of the next case, which presents far graver issues about this issue. All the other expenses were expenses that were, in fact, reliance. They were incidental reliance, but they were all foreseeable. And they were all incurred after the contract was made with the carrier, and they were made in reliance upon the carrier's assurances that the stove would, in fact, be delivered there. All of it, including the missing gas manifold, it would be delivered there by October 8th. You remember, it didn't even get there by October 12th when they took the show down. Okay. Let me ask this question, although, because it's part of the work for tonight, although you may not have asked it to yourself. Suppose the court had said, we're only going to give you restitution remedies. What would the restitution remedy here have been? That come out of left field, that question?
The money that was spent to have the freight carried?
That's it. Just that. The money that was given to the carrier to carry the goods. Because since they failed to carry the goods in accordance with their contract obligation, it is unjust that they retain the freight because they failed to perform their contract. So if only restitution were sought, it would have been that. So here now we see the freight has two different characters. On the one hand, it could be described as restitution. On the other hand, this court doesn't describe it that way. This court describes it as reliance. It is, in fact, both. But here, of course, they're seeking reliance, and so they get it that way. They can't get both reliance and restitution because they can't double recover. You can't get the same amount of money twice. Money from the same explanation, on the same basis. Okay, so much for that. Any questions about that? Now, you might ask yourself, gee, in what other cases, we know why the lawyers asked for reliance here. They ask for reliance because the theory of expectation is to put the client in a position they would have been in had the contract been performed, and there's no way of describing that. Since they weren't there to make money, there's no way of describing what position they've been in, there's no way of quantifying it. We could talk about it in words in general, although we can't be sure, would their prestige be enhanced? Maybe that stove would have been the laughing stock of the show for all we know. Oh my God, you know, what kind of clunky device is that, they might say. These people are lousy at what they do. We would never work with them. I don't know. None of us know. What other kinds of cases, though? So this is a perfect kind of case for asking for reliance damages. What other kinds of cases do you think might be appropriate for asking for reliance damages, other than those where you cannot really, where the contract was not itself engaged to make a profit?
I'm sorry.
Other kinds of situations where you might want to ask for reliance rather than for expectation. A vacation that goes wrong. And why might you ask for reliance there rather than expectation? Right, because you can't really quantify expectations. So there are two ways of describing this, in fact. And you could say the same thing about security stove. You could say that, oh yeah, they did really have a profit in mind. They did really have a vacation in mind. Vacation, it's the pleasures of the vacation, which I suppose we could quantify some way or another. But if we think about quantifying the, sorry. If we think about trying to quantify the stove company's expectation, or we think about quantifying this glorious vacation in Acapulco, we'd say, is there any way of quantifying that that would meet what we know is one of the judicial tests for expectation damages, which we called certainty? Certainty. How? With how much certainty could you value a vacation? With how much certainty could you value the possible enhancement of reputation of the stove company if the stove, in fact, had been well received when it got to Atlantic City and was seen by other elements of the industry? So you'd say in general that these cases are, and they are for the most part, and I'm talking now about where there is consideration and therefore you do have the opportunity to get expectation damages under the law, but there are cases in which there are so great uncertainty that surrounds any effort to quantify loss in expectation terms that you would rather go in and just say, okay, well, at least I want to get rid of the losses that I've experienced based upon my reliance on having this contract, which has now been breached. So those are basically the cases. It involves an evaluation by the lawyer and the client of whether or not they can get past the certainty rule. When I say past it, I don't mean around it. I mean whether they can satisfy the certainty rule. So if we think back at the Dome Stadium case, that was an instance in which they may have, in fact, had significant investment as they were preparing, I don't know whether they did or not, but if they had significant investment as they were preparing to do their part in connection with the Dome Stadium, that would have been a case where they might have said, okay, well, we can't prove with sufficient certainty what our expectation of profit is, so at least let's get our money back, our reliance costs back. Let's put ourselves back in the position that we were in before we made the contract. That is the definition of reliance. Okay. Let's look at Anglia Television Limited versus Reed. This decision was written by a man who I actually knew and very much admired, except for this decision, which I don't admire. Let's assume that the explanation is not an anti-American actor bias, because Lord Denning was not a particularly biased kind of guy, and frankly, I doubt that Lord Denning ever went to a movie anyway. But he was a very distinguished and very learned man, and is responsible for a lot of quite, I will say, progressive decisions in English law. He's dead now. However, how do you explain this decision? The American actor, remember that they had of the $582,750, that's how much this production company was in, having expended on The Man in the Wood, a made-for-TV film. They had expended already they expended $581,900 they had expended. And they were stuck because they needed an actor who could hold the film together. It took them over $500,000 to figure out that they had a film that wasn't holding together. So they needed somebody to hold it together, and they found this guy named Robert Reed, who we are told is an American with a very high reputation as an actor. I won't speak to that, I don't know. Some people have affirmed that that's true. I don't know him. So he says he'll do it. He signs a contract with them. And then he repudiates the contract. He doesn't show up to do the work. So they've expended $581,900, and then they hire Reed, and then he quits, and then they sue him for $582,750 for Reliance expenditures. Now, needless to say, they could not conceivably bring an action for expectation, because they had absolutely no expectation. Right? But the court says, oh, no, Anglia is entitled to recover his damages against Robert Reed, the sum of $582,750, even though $581,900 that had been expended before they made a contract with him. How do you explain that? How does one explain that? This is not the only case of this kind, though I think it is certainly the most extreme case of this kind that I've ever seen.
The court's logic was, when he agreed to do it, he was aware of all the prep work that was needed to be done prior to him ever signing it, and by him backing out, all that prep work money that was incurred prior to him signing would be lost, and he should have been aware of that, and that's why the court assessed those damages to him.
That's what the court says. That's what the court said. I guess that Reed, what would have happened? First of all, let me ask you a few questions about this. What would the principles of mitigation require, do you think, of Anglia in this situation? Now remember, this is a tricky question, because this is not actual mitigation. They didn't actually mitigate, or as far as we know, try to mitigate. So it would have to be under the duty to mitigate head. That is, what did they have any obligation to do after he walks out? I mean, was he the only actor who could be brought in to hold it all together? Of course, after they sued him for that amount of money, believe me, no other actor would sign a contract with these people.
It seems like they tried hard to find a substitute, but they just couldn't find anybody to do it.
If they had not, would they have failed to mitigate? Did they have a duty to mitigate? Are they like an employee that has an obligation when fired in breach of contract, has some kind of obligation to take an alternative job if it's not dissimilar, not a lesser job? I'm being careful because you remember Shirley MacLaine, they gave a lot of leeway to.
It seems unreasonable to not find some other actor. I mean, there must have been someone who could have played the role. I mean, to have spent over $500,000, and then to not even go forward and make the movie because they can't find a good enough substitute for me.
Yeah, I think the explanation for this, I'm just guessing now, but I know a little bit about the business, not a lot. But my guess is that the people who had come up with the money to support this enterprise after Reed quit said, we're out of here. That's it. Not another dime. We're not putting up any more money. And of course, if they're not going to put up any more money, they can't go out and hire anybody else because they don't have any money to hire anybody else. Their ability to hire somebody else depends upon the people who are supporting this operation to continue to plunk money down, which I suspect that they didn't. I think they did have some sort of obligation, but we don't know it. How about the question of foreseeability? What do you think about this argument that he could foresee the expenses that they had already incurred? This is one of the funnier notions. This is a real mind twister, right? I've got to foresee something that has already occurred. Does that mean that I foresee it before it happens? Or I foresee it after happens? I foresee it before I make the contract.
Well, I think it's kind of funny that he couldn't foresee his own schedule, let alone the cost that the production company had expended prior to his even showing up.
Of course, they're the ones who are collecting, so could they foresee it? Could they foresee their losses?
The production company? Because they hired him?
Could they foresee their losses if, having hired him, he quits?
Yeah.
Of course, not only could they foresee them, they've already incurred them. See, the problem here is not foreseeability.
Putting the cart before the horse?
Yeah, there is a cart before the horse. Yeah, well, that's what happened. The horse pushed the cart. So there's no issue here, but for mitigation, there is a question. They would have had to do something, I think. But they probably couldn't, for one reason or another, mitigate. Foreseeability is not an issue because, in fact, remember, it's not his foreseeability. It's their foreseeability. It's what they can foresee. And they, of course, certainly could foresee a loss of $582,000 because they already spent $581,900. The issue instead is, should we do it when they in fact had incurred all of those expenses, not in reliance on a contract with Robert Reed, but in their confidence that they would get a contract? Incidentally, not in confidence that they would get a contract with Robert Reed, but in confidence that they would find some sucker, I'm sorry, that they would find an actor who would sign a contract with them to do this Man in the Wood TV show, a TV movie. I'm troubled by it myself. And some courts deciding this have actually gone back and they've referred to cases like Security Stove and said, see, here's a court that gave the money, even though the expenditure had occurred before the contract, forgetting about the fact that in that case, it was a common carrier contract, and therefore you could foresee that there would be, all was foreseeable. All was when you were relying upon the contract not yet made because you knew that they had to make the contract with you because the law required it. That's not true of Robert Reed. Not true at all. I just think that, you know, now it could be that they decided that after all, England is comparatively poor, America is comparatively rich, or at least it was in 1971. No more. So maybe that's... maybe that's behind it. Okay, one other thing we have to talk about before we can talk about, or a couple of other things, before we talk about restitution. Let's look at this question. Talking about the relationship between expectation and reliance. And here's one way of thinking about the question. Let's suppose that in fact, A makes a contract with B, and A is performing, and B breaches. And an appropriate analysis of the contract would suggest that if A had been allowed to complete performance, B doesn't permit it, if A had completed its performance, and B then had gone ahead and paid the contract price, that A would have experienced a loss. Now that was not his goal. His goal was not to enter into a losing contract, but it's going to be a losing contract anyway. A, instead of bringing an action for expectation, because if he brings an action for expectation, he's got to prove what? He's got to prove the profit he would have made. He can't prove that. So what he does instead is he brings an action for reliance damages. I want all the money that I have spent on this contract prior to the breach. I want to be put back in the position I was in before the contract was entered into. I'm entitled to that. The defendant responds, but if you get back the money that you have expended, there's a possibility here that you will in fact end up better off than you would have had I not breached. And you were required to complete the contract, and I would have paid you, and you would have had a loss. This is a theory which is an argument which is based upon the proposition that the real core kind of goal of contract damages is to put the injured party in the position they would have been in had the contract been performed. Nothing, that's the most you can get. Nothing should exceed that. And so, yeah, maybe you're entitled to reliance damages, but if this is going to be a losing contract, you shouldn't be able to get reliance damages. What did Judge Hand say? This is an opinion written by Learned Hand. We don't see many of his opinions. One of the most famous judges of the 20th century, 21st century, Bridging. And he had the coolest name of any judge, after all. Judge Learned Hand. His cousin also sat on that court for a while. His cousin's name was Augustus Hand. They, for a while, were on the United States Court of Appeals, the Second Circuit, together. That's the one that sits in New York City.
Well, he said that if the defendant can prove that the expectation damages would have been less than reliance damages, then the amount of reliance damages in excess of that cannot be awarded.
Okay. So Learned Hand says, expectation does trump reliance, right? Expectation is what's important, but two things of importance. You said correctly, if who could show that it would have been a loss?
The defendant or the breach.
The defendant, okay? So he said, look, ordinarily the burden of proving damage is on the plaintiff, right? But he says, if the plaintiff seeks reliance damages, the burden of proving that there would have been a loss in expectation terms, that burden is on the defendant. That's a really tough burden on the defendant. Because after all, the defendant knows relatively little. Well, under today's civil procedure standards, they can do lots and lots of discovery. That will help some. Nevertheless, it's a tough burden of proof. Second of all, it's important to remember what this means. So let's just throw some numbers up so we get a look at what it might mean. So let's suppose that this is a contract in which the loss would have been, the defendant proves that there would have been a loss of $500. If the defendant had not breached, the defendant proves that if they had not breached, the plaintiff would have been required to complete the contract, they would have paid the plaintiff, and the result would have been a $500 loss for the plaintiff. The plaintiff proves its reliance losses. They have, after all, that's their burden of proof, their theory is reliance, they prove it, and they prove that, and they want recovery of $1,000 that they've spent in, since the contract was made, they've spent it in reliance on the contract. Most of it was probably essential reliance. That is, it was their cost of performing the contract. If some was incidental reliance, we'll assume that it was foreseeable, just for the sake of argument. Under these facts, what damages would the plaintiff be entitled to in reliance?
$500.
You would subtract this from this. If those numbers are not clear because they're too even, I'll say that he would have lost $700, and therefore his recovery is going to be $300. That is, it doesn't say that he cannot get reliance. It says that his reliance would have to be reduced by the amount of his loss. Why? Because otherwise you would put him in a better position than he would have been in had there been contract performance. If you think about his situation here, if we only give him $300 and he had $1,000 in reliance costs, my goodness gracious, he's going to lose $700 on the contract. Oh yeah, that's what the defendant has proved, that he was going to lose if you assume full performance. Therefore, the argument is that what we should be doing is exactly meeting the expectation standard. We're giving reliance damages, but we're capping it with the philosophy, with the philosophic goal of expectation. I can tell by your enthusiastic reaction how excited you are about the lessons. Okay. There is one other circumstance. Here's another circumstance you see in the casebook involving this same kind of question. Here we have in Westside Galvanizing Services versus Georgia Pacific. There are a couple of questions about this we have to ask. On what theory of recovery is this action being brought? On what theory of liability? I don't mean the remedial theory. What's the liability theory?
Detrimental reliance.
Right, which we otherwise call, by what restatement section?
Section 90.
Section 90, right, section 90. So the court says this is really kind of a section 90 case. Is that the right theory to be using? Should this be a section 90 case? If you wanted to argue that it's a doubtful section 90 case, what might you say? Is this a gift promise? Is the environment here one in which a party is making a gift? You're in the middle of a commercial transaction here among these parties. But nevertheless, there's a promise made. The court says, okay, well, the promise is supported by foreseeable reliance, and therefore we're going to use what measure of damages? Reliance damages. Okay. Now, let's talk about restitution. That's reliance. We've seen reliance damages before. There's nothing startling about it. And we've talked a little bit about why you use it. Let's talk about restitution. We've talked a little bit about restitution, but not much. But restitution is a very complicated topic all in all. We're going to be talking about a rather simple corner of it. Restitution, unjust enrichment, some people call it. The modern language that legal scholars and judges use is usually the word restitution rather than the words unjust enrichment. It really captures the same idea. It is actually not a contract theory at all. It's a theory which arose, it won't surprise you to know, from equity. And it was based upon the idea that if somebody was enriched by the activity of somebody else, and it wasn't intended as a gift and not understood as a gift, then they ought to really give back to the person who was the source of this benefit the value of the benefit. Notice I said the value of the benefit. I didn't say the cost of the benefit. I said the value of the benefit. When we move from the subject of reliance to the subject of restitution, we move from a focus on the reliance expenditures of the aggrieved party, and instead we focus on what benefit the breaching party has received. We want to give back the benefit that the breaching party has received to the aggrieved plaintiff. If we're not in a contract setting, the same thing could be true. And in unjust enrichment law, restitution, there's a large body of recovery which has no contract element at all. However, as the law developed remedies for breach of contract, the law looked over the shoulder, if you will, at this other body of law, which we'll call restitution, and said, you know, there is a core notion in restitution which we could make use of in the panoply of remedies available for breach of contract. So I said in the security railroad case, if the court had said, for example, suppose that none of this stuff was foreseeable, right? There wasn't this extended conversation with a railroad company about, oh yeah, we're going to take our stove to Atlantic City and we're going to show it and we hope to make a, you know. If none of that had occurred, and none of it was therefore foreseeable, we could step in under a theory of restitution and say, look, it's unjust that the railroad retained the fee for services which it never rendered. At least it didn't render them properly. It's unjust that they retained that payment. If you remember in when we talked about buyer's remedies against the breaching seller, the introductory language, which starts out by talking about all the things that could happen that would be a seller's breach, it says, among other things, the buyer, in addition to recovering the deposit paid, may, and then it goes ahead and talks about reference to cover and reference to market contract differential damages. The getting back of the deposit they paid, that's restitution. That's restitution. So there is an important idea here, and the idea is that, well, if nothing else, certainly the plaintiff ought to be able to get back from the defendant some benefit that the defendant has received from the plaintiff. Usually, of course, as a result of the plaintiff's performance of the contract up until the moment of breach. And the defendant is sitting there with a benefit. As we'll see on Monday night, it can happen the other way around. Let's suppose, for example, that I work and my contract says I'll be paid at the end of the year. One payment, end of the year. I work for 6 months. In breach of contract, I walk off the job. I'm the bad guy, I walked off the job. On the other hand, he's not paid me and my employer got 6 months of work out of me. That was valuable work. Now they may also have some losses. They have a damage suit against me for losses they sustained by having to go out and hire somebody else, probably maybe at a higher wage. And I owe them that as damages, but don't they owe me something? Well, sure, I've benefited them. And therefore, restitutionary principle, I should be able to get back from them the value of what I have given them. So restitution doesn't even rest, it's not limited to contract breach, but it exists in the realm of contracts. And it's always talking about the benefit received. Now, unfortunately, sometimes when courts do this, instead of saying that we are measuring damages by the benefit the defendant received, sometimes measure the benefit that defendant received by the expenditure, the cost to the plaintiff. That's not the way they're supposed to do it. You can justify it if you say, oh yeah, well, we can tell what the benefit was by looking at what it cost. It's better practice, and most courts will do this, to say, what we'll do is we'll look at it this way. We'll ask this question. What would the breaching defendant have had to pay in the marketplace for the goods or services that it has as a result of the contract performance by the plaintiff? What would it have had paid to somebody else? Frequently, of course, the answer is the same as the contract price, or pro rata the contract price. But not always. not always. I mean, you get these really sometimes quite weird cases. You take a look, for example, at this really terribly awful case of Oliver versus Campbell. Right, that's on 353, the lawyer case. The lawyer has said that they'll represent in a divorce action, separate maintenance and divorce action, the final judgment for a fee of $850, including $100 for costs and incidentals. And they are going on, and things aren't going very well, and they lose at the trial court. So the lawyer says, oh no, we're going to appeal. And they get fired by the client. So the lawyer then turns around and sues the client for, I don't know, $5,000. On what theory? Well, restitution. I want the value of the services that I've rendered to the defendant. Not what did it cost me, not what is the contract price, but the value. How should that be measured? It should be measured by asking a question of what would this client have to pay for a lawyer to do what I've done? And if the answer is $5,000, then the judgment is $5,000. Now, the reason the lawyer did not recover the money was that the court said, oh yeah, but we have another rule. Our rule is, what? What is the rule that prevented this lawyer from getting this, I think, ridiculous recovery of $5,000?
Didn't they say that you pretty much performed the contract in full?
So right, so what's the rule?
That you can't get restitution if you...
Okay, see, that, I always like legal arguments to start with a rule. So the court said that the rule is that if a contract is either completely performed on one side or is mostly performed on that side, then you are not entitled to seek damages measured by restitution. Not entitled to restitution because the contract is fully or almost fully performed. And you see that rule poking its head up. But if it had not been that way, if, let's say, he had been fired halfway through the trial, then this court would have said the damages the lawyer can get are to be measured by the value of the services rendered, which shall be judged by what it would cost to obtain those services in general in the marketplace, and it will not be limited by the contract price. Quite extraordinary notion. But it is a core notion in the law of in the damage law of restitution. Algernon Blair. Remember, there's the case involving the breach because the contractor refused to pay for a rental cost of a crane. The subcontractor had to pay for the crane. But that was a breach of contract, the court says. Subcontractor said, and the court agreed, that was a breach of contract by the contractor. So the subcontractor, not having... under those circumstances, the contract having been breached, they walk off the job, which they're entitled to do because the contractor breached, and they sue the contractor for damages, and the contractor says, and they sue for not reliance, not expectation, for restitution. Why don't they sue for expectation?
They were
going to lose profit.
Sorry, they were not going to gain profit.
They were going to go one step further now.
They were going to lose money.
Right, that's it. They were going to lose money. Exactly, right. Yeah, exactly right. They're going to lose money. You don't want to sue for expectation if you're going to manage to prove it would have been a losing contract. Okay, now they could have sued for reliance. They could have. But they instead decide to sue for restitution. And when they sue for restitution, they are not limited by the contract price. The court says the standard for measuring the reasonable value of the services rendered is the amount for which such services could have been purchased from one in the plaintiff's position at the time and place the services were rendered. That has to go back to the trial court to determine that. So this is a restitutionary recovery. That, now notice this about this case. The court doesn't talk at all about whether this is a substantial breach or an insubstantial breach. They don't say a word about that. And yet, if we look back now at Osteen versus Johnson, that's the records case. You remember the singer, and they have a contract for developing the record, and she has one record, and the record is actually quite successful, but then the person with whom they've contracted, for whatever reason, never makes, or at least never distributes a second record. And they are suing here for restitutionary damages. Now, in this case, what did restitution mean? What could they get back?
The price that they, the money they had paid.
Yeah. All they're trying to get back is the money they've paid. This is restitution the way Security Stove would have been restitution, trying to get back the cost of freight. All they want is they want their money back. So here the court extends, it goes into an extensive discussion of whether or not this was a, quote, substantial breach that had been committed. And they conclude that it was a substantial breach because, well, one record was successful and they had failed to develop the second record, which would have meant a lot of money. That was important. That was important. So if they had left undone something important, the breach was substantial. But there's not a word about how substantial the breach was in Algernon Blair. That is, how important a breach was it that the contractor did not pay for the cost of renting the crane? We don't know. The court didn't care. So you see, one of the differences that you're going to see in restitution cases is the court, you have three different things we've talked about in that, or two different things. One is whether or not the contract has been substantially performed. And in Oliver versus Campbell, the court says if it's been substantially performed, then you cannot sue for restitution. You have to sue on the contract, in which case you're going to be limited by the contract price. So all the lawyer could in the end get would be $850, because that was the contract price, not the $5,000. You also know that at least in some courts, if there has been substantial performance, and we're not now talking about a case involving, we've switched sides in terms of where the money goes and where the service goes. Here, this is a case by the person who paid the money bringing an action against the person who was performing the service. And the court says if they've substantially performed, they're limited to what? Contract damages, whatever that would mean, not restitution. I'm not sure why. Algernon Blair, they say, no. We don't even ask that question. There's been a breach by the defendant. You're entitled to restitution. So we don't really know from court to court how important this question is going to be. The one thing I will tell you, it's perfectly clear that if the contract is just about completely performed, no court is going to give restitutionary damages. At some point, you see, the court says, look, we've got to be limited to the contract price. We can give back the money to the plaintiff who spent the money if the plaintiff, if the defendant breached. We can do that, but whatever we do is going to be limited by the contract price if the contract has been mostly completed on one side. On the other hand, what that degree is differs among the courts. So if you have a case and you're seeking restitutionary damages, you want to be prepared to make the case that there was still a lot of important stuff that was yet to be done under the contract. And if you're trying to resist restitution because you'd much rather be found to have breached the contract and pay on an expectation basis or even on a reliance basis, maybe. Then what you're going to say is, Your Honor, the contract was just about done. It was just about complete. There was hardly anything of value left to do, thereby trying to confine the plaintiff to the contract price.
I understand what you, the concept you're saying in terms of how and on whether they're going to measure their the value, but in a sense, how isn't aren't they isn't the plaintiff kind of being unjustly enriched by them because they're given the value of their services on this contract where they're losing money, where if they fully perform,
that's right.
Why wouldn't they just be given what their expenses?
It's a great question. Why would they? Aren't they being, isn't there some unjust enrichment here? Doesn't it violate what Hand said in Armstrong Rubber? Wasn't Hand right that the limit of recovery in contract cases for contract breach should be expectation, should be the outer limit? And this use of restitution violates that principle. It puts the injured party in a better position than they would have been in had there been full performance. Because I think we have to assume that that was the case here. That if they had fully performed the contract and they had been paid, they would have lost money, a lot. And that possibility is not a limitation in restitution cases the way we saw it was a limitation in reliance cases. Why? What's the difference between restitution and reliance? There's a stark difference, of course, in terms of the source of law. The source of reliance damages is contract theory. The source of restitutionary damages is not contract theory. It comes from a separate, independent, equitable notion. But that's not the only reason. Think about the difference between reliance and restitution. When it comes to reliance damages, you're looking at money that's going here, there, and the other place. That is, that suppose that we look at the railroad, the carrier, I'm sorry, the stove company in the Atlantic City stove case. They were paying money to the hotel. They were paying money to the convention center. They were paying money to employees. Right? None of that was money that was going to the railroad. Restitution. If they brought a restitution action, the money they're getting back is money that went to the railroad that breached the contract. That is, when you think about restitution, the victim, the defendant here, has benefited. And they've breached. So if they've benefited and they've breached, yeah, it's true that the plaintiff may end up better off than they would have been. But why should the defendant end up better off than they would have been? Right? I'm really choosing between these two, and I don't really want the plaintiff to be any better off than he would have been had there been full performance, because I like expectation. But on the other hand, hey, that means that I'm benefiting this breaching party who's making money out of being a breacher. And with all due respect to Judge Posner and the efficient breach and all that, it's never been taken that far. So I think that the explanation is that in restitution, the courts have not cared about imposing that limit of, gee, are we overcompensating the plaintiff? Because they don't basically care. They don't want the defendant to benefit. And all the focus in restitution is the unjust benefit that is being retained by the defendant who breached the contract. Some courts like to say, look, if the defendant says that, oh, well, the plaintiff would have lost that money, they had a way of finding out whether that was true or not. All they had to do was perform the way they promised to. But they failed to. They breached. So we don't want to hear them. And as I say, I think the explanation lies in the fact that we are really talking about the benefit is the bad guy. If we think about reliance expenses, I mean, there are a whole lot of people who've made money, who've gotten money out of that reliance. They're not the defendant. They're other people. And therefore, if we imposed on the defendant those, then it does really not sound good. It's not much justification for leaving the plaintiff better off than he would have been had the contract been performed. But there is seen to be a justification for doing exactly that in cases in which the defendant breached. Now, that already teaches you something that you'll learn and we'll talk about on Monday night. That is, hey, how does that logic work if it's the breaching party who's saying, oh, well, the defendant, who is the non-breaching party, owes me money because I benefited them? What then? Now, the same logic is not going to obtain to take us outside the contract price, because the defendant is the good guy. Yes, they benefited, but they didn't breach. It's the plaintiff that breached. And we'll see what result. Guess what? The contract price is the limit. All right. We'll be back at this. If you have some questions, I hope you will, ask them. Ask them on the forum. Ask them when class, by email. Ask them when class begins on Monday. Otherwise, we're going to start with Cutson versus Pierney. We're going to talk about the breaching party bringing an action for restitution. We'll see how that works out. And then we're going to talk about these fund cases that begin on introduction and interpretation. And we'll certainly talk about Lucy versus Zimmer and Raffles versus Whipplehouse. And at least we're going to launch into Forgilliman. So you've really got to read through Forgilliman. And again, if you've not gotten a look, check your mail, but if you've not gotten a comment from me, it's a PDF attachment to your essay, you will by noon tomorrow.